Good evening, Larry. Happy anniversary.
Well, good evening and happy anniversary to us.
Yes, to us. Here, wait. You ready for this? I came prepared. Episode 1 was released on October 22nd of 2017, which happens to be the exact same day that we're going to release this episode, which will be on Monday, 10/22/2018.
Well, congratulations. We finished a year and we have many more to go.
We do. Tell me what you thought about the idea when we first when I first approached you about it.
Being technologically challenged and not really understanding what a podcast was, I didn't think a whole lot of it, but I've learned to be open to new ideas because I brought a lot of new ideas into the advocacy with NARSL with things that they hadn't thought of.
Very good. And to celebrate our year anniversary, I thought we would list our patrons in the order in which they started supporting us. So here are in order. So we have Dave and Travis, Butcher TM. I don't have any more information on that, so that's just your name. Then we have Horace, and then we have Michael in Florida. We have Michael in New Jersey, Justin, Larry, Patty.
Oh, we have Hank, Jennifer, Jane, Christian, Marlene, Tim, David, Gerald, and Hal.
Thank you very much to you people for supporting the podcast. It means a whole lot to us that these people support us and have supported us for so long.
It really, really does. I'm humbled beyond humble to think that us getting together on Saturday afternoon to record this, that there's so many people listening to us and so many people placing value on it. It's just thank you so much for it. It inspires us to want to do a better job when we have this level of support.
Very true. Very true. So to then close that out, we love your questions and a big shout out to our patrons who. Over at patreon.com/registrymatters. It's the best way to support us, support the show, and we love each and every one of you. Also the ones that may not be able to contribute financially, but our thanks to you. Join the crew that makes Registry Matters happen. Join us at patreon.com/registrymatters. I was listening to a different podcast. It was a science one with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and they had a psychologist or like a neurosurgeon on there. Give me a second. This will get relevant. If you could identify a part of a person's brain that made them have some sort of criminality, and we'll just call it a tumor for simplicity. So you could actually see like this walnut sized thing in their brain, and you could remove it, and you remove it the day after the person commits some sort of heinous crime. You've fundamentally altered who that person is. You've treated them and you've cured them of what caused the criminality. Would you still go and bring them to court and try them for that crime tomorrow or, you know, whenever that would come about?
Why not?
Is it the person that committed the crime? Is it the brain, or is it the flesh sack, the shell that did the crime?
Well, the person committed the crime. The alteration of the person's mind doesn't change the fact that that person did the act, does it?
I am inclined to think that my opinion would be yes, it does. That the person is no longer the same person that committed the crime. You have removed the element that made it happen.
You're starting to sound like a liberal do-gooder.
And the reason why I bring that up is if you would agree to those conditions, then if you were to treat someone through psychological treatment and so forth, call it like the post-incarceration or even the during incarceration treatment programs, you've deemed the person treated, then shouldn't they just then go on to live their life as a normal citizen?
Well, I mean, on a serious note, you are talking about what was referred to as the medical model.
Yeah, I am.
And America used to believe in the medical model when we had a more progressive outlook on how we dealt with offenders. But the medical model largely evaporated in the late 70s and 80s when we got so much more harsh.
Tough on crime.
There was a time that we did believe that people committed crimes because of a number of factors, and many of them were related to emotional dysfunctionality, and there with proper treatment, whatever the need was could be addressed, and that person could be restored. European nations still use that, but we've moved towards a more punitive model in America.
So that's pretty much a the barn door is closed, so to speak. The horses are out. We're done.
Well, that's going to require that Americans have a fundamental change in their outlook about what is in our interest as a society. And we have to first mature to the point where we realize that we're in this together. And it seems like, as I've gotten older, it seems like we're less willing to admit we're in this together, that we all depend on one another. We've become more about the individual. We claim we made it all ourselves. And
I am very much with you on that idea. I don't see how that thought process works, that if you don't want to spend the $50,000 a year to put someone in jail, if you don't want to keep spending it, fine, they go to jail, or you spend the 50 grand, they come out. It still seems in all of our best interests that that person not continue that sort of behavior that put them there in the first place. And we should make every effort to prevent them from doing it in the future.
Well, I agree. But in terms of that, we made it all ourselves. I tell people that you can take some of the really successful people in America that started with very little, the entrepreneurs, but without the stability of American society, which required a lot of contributions, of collective contributions, those people, if you'd put them in Somalia or South Sudan with their same brilliance, they would not make it, because the prior investment capital would not have been put in place. If you don't have national security, if you don't have domestic tranquility, if you don't have infrastructure, if you don't have education, if you don't have public health, if you don't have all these systems in place that are collectively paid for, then a person, no matter how brilliant they are, they're not going to be able to make it by and large and become successful entrepreneurs. Why do you think we don't hear about entrepreneurs out of Somalia?
Because they don't have an infrastructure to create anything novel or unique and all that.
Yeah, they haven't collectively invested in, well, of course, we have a lot of natural bountiful resources that we were blessed with in this country, but they have not invested the resources that they have wisely, and they've not pulled together for the collective good. For a long time, this country did pool their resources for the collective good, and we were willing to make decisions that were tough decisions to tell people, I'm sorry, that's not in the collective interest. Can you imagine the debate that happened back before our time about compulsory education, when you're prying kids away from their parents on the farms?
Right, that probably went over pretty poorly.
Can you imagine the debate that would have occurred when child labor was more accepted in the workplace, and we had a lot of children being injured on the job? Can you imagine the debate that took place? But we said collectively, we're going to build these walls of protection for the greater good. When child welfare services were being invented, perhaps they've gone too far. It's always a careful balance. But can you imagine the debate with the states that were first to say that we have to have child welfare intervention services to keep kids safe from abuse? There would have been a lot of disbelief about that. The kids are mine to do with as I damn well please. And who the hell's the government coming here?
Right. I made them. I will treat them however I damn please.
But America, people who think that you did this all yourself, you don't provide the systems that make this country work. We've had generous investment through 200 plus years that have made this country work. And I feel like that we're becoming very chintzy about what we're willing to invest to make this country stay ahead. If you look at our infrastructure, it's not the world's greatest infrastructure anymore. Even President Trump has announced and acknowledged that in many ways we're third world infrastructure. Our airports are not the best.
And long before that, while I was down, 2008, maybe 2010, our education systems were ranking in the 30s, you know, depending on which subject you're talking about. So we definitely have room for improvement.
We do, but we have to not be selfish. We have to be willing to tax ourselves now. And when a progressive refers to this stuff as investment, they scarf. They say, well, there they go again. They call it investment. Well, that's actually what it is. The Certainly. Eisenhower Interstate Highway System was an investment, a very huge investment. The emphasis we put on NASA in the 1960s and 70s was a very huge investment. It's paid enormous dividends in terms of where we are with technology and what we're able to do today.
But still reaping the rewards of all that too.
And we don't think of that. We've belittled public investment and degraded it, and people are not supportive of NASA's a shell of what it once was.
Yes, it is. But why do we need to learn all about that crazy space stuff? What does that have to do with anything?
Well, I
suppose. And to circle back to Tyson, Tyson says, let's not make America great again. Let's make America smart again.
I love it.
Yep. Well, we did receive an email message from a patron named Michael. This is the one in Florida. And he says, hey, the podcast last week was great. I've not missed one since I found you. You and Larry are great at what you do, and the podcast is very important to me, and I'm sure many others. I personally don't care which side of the political world you two fall on, because over and over you have voiced reason and sound judgment about doing what's right over what's popular, politicians' opinion. I really appreciate all the hard work and look forward to many more great episodes. I would also like to encourage everyone to please take as little or as much as you can and support the podcast on Patreon. I don't always have extra money, but I have supported the cast for a few months now and will continue to do so as long as I can afford it. Take care, guys. Thank you for that, Michael. It's really great to hear from the listeners.
Thank you, Michael. And we appreciate you and all the support you've given us.
Yep. Oddly, I was speaking to a friend of mine who's in the Air Force, and I just shared with him that we do the podcast, and he listens to it on a regular basis. He's not one of our people, has no ties to the situation at all, but he gave some feedback. He said, it sounds like we are in the same room. He thinks that there's this great rapport between us. He thinks that it's an excellently produced podcast, and I was really appreciative of his feedback that way. His name is Todd, so we can give a shout out to Todd if he happens to hear this.
Well, thank you, Todd. And you just don't know all the arguments we have when we're not recording.
That is probably true. to follow up on the whole Tennessee situation going on, William phoned in again with this.
This is William again, the registrant in Tennessee who first called in last week about the 11-day curfew in Tennessee. And I have found out that how they handle it varies from area to area. The Shelby County Sheriff, which covers Memphis, covers all registered offenders in Memphis and Shelby County. And where I live, just the offenders that are subject to active TDOC supervision, which means community supervision for life, and their 12th rule is kind of their catch-all that allows them to add any other restriction based on viewed risk factors as detected by either the officer or the treatment provider. So I guess under that general rule, the CSL gives them the right to impose the curfew on us. But other sheriffs, you know, like I said, in Shelby County, they do it to all their registrants, whether or not they're on active supervision. So I don't see any uniform policy that guides this in the state of Tennessee, and I'm wondering how to proceed in dealing with this issue, because, like you said, I can't go to church for two straight Wednesday night services, and I see that absolutely as an impermissible intrusion into my First Amendment right to worship. But I wanted to call in and let you know, keep you up with what I'm finding out, because I am digging and looking for information, but I thought I'd call and let you guys know. Thank you and keep up the great work. I look forward to listening to the next podcast.
So what advice do you have for William, Larry?
I would suggest, I've actually reached out to attorney Jeff Lee, who has been on our Northland Action Calls before, and I did not get a response, and I don't know if he's busy or decided he doesn't want to touch this, but he was the one who had told us that this applies to all offenders in Tennessee, and I couldn't locate the actual statutory language that supports that since the caller has left these messages. What I would encourage him to do, he sounds like a very well-spoken and level-headed individual. I would ask for the authority, the legal authority that confines people for 11 days so that I can take a look at it. And if we can see by what authority they're claiming, now he mentioned the CSL, which is community supervision for life, which is something they've retroactively done in Tennessee, and they're calling it civil non-punitive, a civil regulatory scheme to take people who had already finished their supervision requirements and imposed another reporting requirement with conditions for life. I don't think that would be constitutional if it were challenged, but there again, it's presumed constitutional until it is declared unconstitutional by a court. I really need the authority by which they're giving these orders to. If he's being ordered to stay home for 11 days, under what authority? They'll either give him a state statute or they'll give him some regulatory scheme number and tell him that's under this authority. And just simply, we're telling you to do it, it's really not good enough. And if they say that's all because we're telling you to, I would politely tell them that that doesn't constitute legal authority as far as I know, unless there's a statute section in Tennessee that says you'll do anything that law enforcement tells you. And some states have catch-all provisions in there that says that they can collect such information and impose requirements that are consistent with the purposes of sex offender registration, and it gives a broad amount of latitude. There again, that's probably unconstitutional, those type of catch-all provisions, but they're presumed constitutional until they're challenged. So what he can do is get us the exact authority by which they're operating under, and then we can figure out if there's a viable challenge and a way to fund it. Having a viable challenge and a way to fund it is always the stumbling block.
Interesting. Can William reach out to us and I get it to you? Do you have interest in helping more directly, or does he need to get with the attorneys in Tennessee?
Well, I would be willing to try to facilitate as an interface if we can get the authority by which they're giving these instructions. And if it looks like it's dubious, I can reach out to Mr. Lee again, see if he's interested, and there are other attorneys in Tennessee, so we don't have to stop at his office. But Tennessee is a conservative state. The courts tend to be very conservative in Tennessee, so we're probably be looking at a federal action of some sort to have any chance with an Article 3 judge. A state-elected judge in Tennessee is probably going to be very representative of the people of Tennessee, which is very conservative.
Yeah, to use your expression, I'm sure that the handlers there are pure as the wind-driven snow, and they wouldn't go outside of their scope of authority to well, of course, keep people confined, right?
Of course they would. Absolutely they would. They do it all the time. They used to do it in my state until we got on their butt about it and to remind them that there was no restrictions on Halloween for people not under probation or parole supervision, but they were doing it here, telling everybody you must be home, your lights must be out, and you can't answer the door, hand out candy.
And they didn't have the legal authority to do it, so you guys said FYP?
That's pretty much what we did. We did a press release, and we notified the law enforcement in the major counties that were doing it that you can't do that. And did they
push back though? Did they try and institute?
They didn't. They stopped doing it. They'll still go to the people's door and check on them, but they don't tell them they have to be home. They still do home checks.
I was looking through the list of articles and I came across one. It actually happened to be down in Savannah talking about, you know, make sure that you're checking where the registrants live to make sure your kids are safe. And like, at least in this state, you can't do anything related to Halloween starting at least here 5 o'clock at night. So you don't need to post a map. They're going to be like lights out, not answering doors. They're effectively, quote unquote, not home for them to do anything with your kids anyway.
Well, does that apply to everybody or just a supervised population?
My understanding, it's everybody on the registry. I don't think that stops when you get off supervision.
Well, then we'll have to. I don't remember that being in the Georgia statute last time I looked at it, that there was any requirement on people who are not under supervision.
Oh, and I could have that wrong. I could totally have that wrong. Well, let's move on with the list of articles. And we got a juicy one at the end. I think we teased it last week about the internet stuff, but let's get this
one. That's a great one. I've read the case now.
Good, 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 good. Well, this one, this one will be quick. This one is from the New York Daily News, and it's a law that seals old criminal records helps New Yorkers find new work and better lives. The article profiles a woman who, like, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, she did something that she ended up with a record, and then forever she won't apply for jobs where they might do some kind of background check. And this new provision that allows her records to be sealed, now she is able to go get a much better paying job with a lot more freedom in her life. So this sounds like something that more states, I mean, this is a pretty liberal state as things go. They do have some kind of conservative leanings though at times. They're pretty like locked down on certain issues, but this seems like, why wouldn't we do this for everybody to let them live past their worst day in life?
It's beginning to be a trend, and actually it is catching on in some conservative states as well, that there's always the exception for sex offenders and certain violent criminals,
right.
But it's a step in the right direction. The same thing in New York, they have that exception for certain violent crimes and sexual offenders. But I always tell people I'm an incremental person. If I can save as many lives as I can, officials estimated that 600,000 people could have their records sealed under New York's law, but few have applied, only 549. That kind of is similar to our numbers here in our cause. You've got 700, yes. 800, 900,000, and only a few hundred of support the cause. Well, 600,000 people are eligible for sealing and 549 have applied. Now, it may be I would not conclude from that people don't want the record sealed. I would conclude from that either there's been a lack of knowledge that it's not known, or it's too cumbersome of a process, or a combination of the two.
Or even like they're just slow rolling the moving the paperwork through.
Well, this theoretically have applied wouldn't necessarily mean that they've been decided, but getting the word out, this is not something that where there's a lot of interest in funding public service announcements to get this out and doing a lot of outreach. It's kind of like a little program we have in this state for people who have disabilities. They can get a $230 a month state general assistance payment. There's absolutely no outreach done on that program because it's all state funded. It's a program that singles are eligible for, but they have to have a disability. Well, there's no outreach done on it because since it's all state funds, nobody wants to spend outreach dollars to exacerbate a state funded program that's already $5 or $6 billion that they're spending on general assistance. So this here may be something where lack of outreach, and then it may be too cumbersome, but it's a step in the right direction. And we need to get more active in the lobbying campaign when they discuss this as to why all sex offenders are excluded, and maybe try to narrow that exclusion. I mean, I prefer it not exist, but at least have, okay, why are the people that have consensual Romeo and Juliet, why are they excluded? And go down the litany of things and see if you could have a dialogue with lawmakers about why they want to just exclude everyone who has a sexual offense.
Right, right. Yeah, that one's, that would be great for more people to know. Only that's a tenth of a percent. That's less than a tenth of a percent of the people are that have been had their record sealed out of 600,000. That's a lot. 600,000 people? That's a lot of people with felonies in New York.
And there's already a narrow criteria. You can't have more than two crimes, and only one can be a felony.
And it has to have been more than 10 years ago, I think it said also.
Yeah, so it's a narrow law, but yet 600,000 are potentially eligible and 1%. Or is it a tenth of a percent? Not even 1%.
It's a tenth of.
I was a mathematician, right?
Clearly, that's why you work in the legal profession, because math doesn't matter then.
That's right.
Hey, tell me what you think about solitary confinement. Do you think it's a good way to treat people, or is it a bad way to treat people?
That's another example of we put too many people in solitary confinement, and it's very hard on the human to be isolated from human contact. You've been in correctional settings more than I have, but can you imagine 23 hours a day being isolated and having a little hole opened once or twice a day? I guess they feed maybe as much as three times a day, unless you're in Joe R. Pyle's jail. But having this little slot open and being able to come out for 45 minutes to an hour for hygiene and for exercise, provided they have staffing. And solitary confinement is too often used. It's too easy to mouth off at a correctional officer and get put in solitary confinement. And it's a lazy way of managing prisons when you have someone who needs a little more protection. Well, we'll just lock them down. That's protective custody. Isn't it strange that while you're supposed to be protected, that you get deprived of so many things while you're supposed to be protected?
Lose your commissary privileges just because someone may have jumped you and now you end up in solitary.
It's kind of like the pre-trial detention. Well, if you're in solitary confinement for your own protection, theoretically, you shouldn't lose your privileges of the telephone and whatever sparse
Correct.
Privileges you have because you're in solitary confinement. But often you do, and you lose the opportunity to interact, and you lose opportunity for exercise. And it's just America's again, the civilized world looks at us and wonders why we do this with our inmates, put so many of them in lockdown.
To circle back around, this article is coming out of the Washington Post. It's an opinion piece by the editorial board. And some numbers that I did not know about, and you know, maybe this is fake news because it's the Washington Post, because that's definitely not trusted trusted news sourcing. It is estimated that between 80 and 100,000 prisoners are in solitary lockup, it says. Last year, the number pegged at roughly 61,000. And that is only in the prison population. Then they said that there's another whole bunch of them that are in isolation in the county jails, city and county jails, for another 740,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Well, and that's what they did to Nelson Mandela.
Right.
If anybody remembers who he is from South Africa.
So there's that. We're a great group of people because we put people in lockup. And yeah, forgive me for making this analogy, but if you put a dog in a run in the backyard and you never go see it, the dog just starts running around, doing like there's a path around the perimeter of the kennel, and the dog gets really, really warped because they're social creatures. You can make a lot of analogs between them and us as far as their social structure and how they react if you keep them in solitary confinement for long periods of time. They are very messed up animals. If you keep us in solitary confinement for very long, you end up with some really, really strange results as being human beings, and you see how animalistic we really are.
Well, the article noted that in Louisiana, they have nearly 20% of the state's male inmates locked away in solitary confinement.
Great state, man. And it's funny, that's another conservative state. I'm just gonna throw it out there. The conservative states treat their people more poopy than the liberal progressive states.
You can't say that on this podcast.
It's evidence. We can go point to all the different maps and just look whether they're reddish leaning or bluish leaning and see how they treat their people, how much they spend on their jails and so forth. That's going to be an indisputable fact.
I did that in 2014 at the Dallas Arsenal conference in Dallas. I had the high incarceration states, so they were all in the South, and then I did the low incarcerations, and they were all in the more liberal part of the country. And I asked the Dallas people audience, I said, well, we got a conservative audience here. Are Northerners more inherently, are Southerners more inherently criminal than these states? Or do they have a better, I mean, you explain it to me and nobody could.
Right. I know it. Here's one that could have some far-reaching impact for our people when they are off supervision. And it says, you better bring a warrant to come check out my house. From theappeal.org, a man convicted of obstruction for refusing to open his door for police. And the subtitle says, if the conviction stands, it could criminalize people who refuse to do things like unlock their phones or garages at the request of the police. It's definitely a subject that I'm interested in. Like, you just have a mountain of data on your phone since they made this tie over into your phone. You've got banking information, you've got like your whole social structure, all your contacts, all that stuff. And if they ask you to unlock your phone, it's not like you have a feature phone like you barely just got rid of, Larry, just a little flip phone. You have so much data on here. And if they ask you to unlock it, you're giving them so much more information than just the contact information. So here's this guy, the neighbors report that that they heard like some glass breaking in the house. So maybe they think there's a fight between him and his partner, and the police are called, and he says, no, you can't come in. And the cops are like, you need to let us in. We need to check this. So there's this crazy line between what is their obligation to keep the public safe versus your Fourth Amendment and other civil liberties, as far as like your property and stuff like that, that they can't cross without permission or a warrant.
And I put this article in here because of that very reason. Now, in terms of your phone, the U.S. Supreme Court has already ruled that they cannot just search your phone without a warrant. Even the old justices could identify with what a treasure trove of information is in your phone and how that's equivalent to your house. But this is a situation. The reason why I put it in here is because we hear about all these intrusions when they're doing the home verifications, and they use the justification, even though it's not required in most state statutory schemes, there's no requirement to go door to door. the law enforcement, which is usually elected officials, they decide to do it because it looks good on their PR. It looks good that we're going to check on these people. And they operate under what's the community caretaker doctrine, which is what the police hung their hat on. This is out of Washington State. And the police said, well, as under the community caretaker doctrine, we have to assure that there's no one being hurt. And we had reports of broken glass, and we wanted to make sure that there's not a safety issue inside. And the person said, too bad, so sad, I'm not opening the door. So they exercised their own means of entry, and they arrested him for contempt of cop because he wouldn't open the door. And the jury in Washington convicted him, and the appellate courts in Washington have upheld this conviction. And it's now before the U.S. Supreme Court. So the public defenders are seeing, although it's a very laborious process to get something to the U.S. Supreme Court, they've seen the significance of this. And I see the significance in terms of the home verifications, because we get these complaints all the time that they demand entry. And if they demand entry and this decision stands, my fear is if the U.S. Supreme Court, now that they've got the case, say that the Washington Supreme Court got it right, then all bets are off in terms of when they knock at the door and say, we want to do a home verification, can we take a look around? They'll argue the community caretaker doctrine, that we're there to make sure that to keep the community safe. These are a high-risk population, and they've been convicted of these heinous crimes, and we just want to make sure that they're not plotting their next move. I'm fearful that this, so that's why I put it in.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. Yeah, so this one's going to make it all the way up to SCOTUS, right?
It says it's there, and it says the oral argument was scheduled for Thursday. I don't know if it was this past Thursday. It says, well, according to the oral argument. So,
20th. Right. Yeah. So that would have been just a couple of days ago, Thursday, 2 days ago. Interesting.
Well, today's the 20th, but either there our arguments were scheduled for last Thursday or this Thursday, and I haven't pulled the briefs or anything, but just the description of this is frightening. And of course, we've got a different Supreme Court now. It may be that they see the overreach of government and they say, you can't do that. We'll just have to wait and see where we get Gorsuch and Kavanaugh on this.
Well, stop right there for a second. If they are going to possibly say, an overreach of government, aren't they also then going to side with that the police need all the resources they can to do their job?
That tends to be where the conservatives come down. I was being a little tongue in cheek there.
But they also do have a tendency to push back against government overreach too.
Well, not so much on this area. That's where our people often get it wrong.
Okay.
When it comes to police doing their day-to-day work, the conservative courts do not tend to interfere with police procedures. And that's what this is. This is a police procedure of how they handle a day-to-day situation they encounter countless times when there's domestic violence. This would be very common in a domestic violence situation. Somebody hears emotion, and the police say, we have a duty to make sure that people are safe. And this is going to be a very interesting case, because the conservatives generally tend to defer to the police in terms of what they're doing in their day-to-day operations. And we'll just see if they have an epiphany, if they come around, and if they how the breakout of the vote. But if this is already on the docket, then there's going to be a decision by June at the end of the term.
Interesting. Well, then we have an article.
We will follow this one, folks. I'll get more information, and we'll put this on our monitoring to follow when, as the term draws to a conclusion, because they'll definitely decide it by the end of the term.
Right. And then moving on to the Arizona Capital Times article, where justices, you can't jail homeless sex offenders for not registering new address. The scenario here would be maybe you're in a halfway house, so you have that address registered. Then for whatever reason, you get moved out of there. Now you can't find housing. So you go find the nearest local bridge that you can pitch a tent under. And what address do you register? Like the third bridge past the creek? And so somebody did that, and he got locked up for not registering the address, if I understand the story right. And so the justices there said, no, you can't lock him up for that. He told you where he was.
So this is an issue that's been fought all over the country, and it's a no-brainer. But yet my good friends in Arkansas and I had a vehement disagreement about that when they were so excited that they had changed their law so that a homeless sex offender would have to register once a week. And they said that was better than them being prosecuted because they got the legislature to require registration weekly for a homeless offender and they could declare on their form transient. Prior to that, they had to declare an address, which was consistent with what happened in Georgia. You had the case with State versus Santos back, I believe, in 2008. But in every state where this has been taken to the Supreme Court of the state, they have said that if you are homeless and you do not have an address, you cannot give that which you do not have, which makes it impossible for you to comply with that part of the law. Now, it doesn't exempt you from registering. It doesn't say that. And I had an argument with a person who wanted to move to Pennsylvania when their Supreme Court said that not being able to declare a physical address, they were exempt from that component of registration. I said, no, there's a lot more to registering. You can still give your DNA. You can still give a whole bunch of information. You just don't have an address. So the court didn't say you don't have to register. They said you can't be jailed for being homeless. Well, even in Arizona, which is pretty conservative by and large, their court said if you don't have an address, you can't give what you don't have, but you still have to register what you do have. The Arizona legislature, if they haven't already, they're going to have to prescribe a process where if rather than the statute saying you must provide an address, they'll do what other states have done. They'll say you have to provide a physical address or the approximate location where you stay on a nightly basis. And if it changes, then you need to report it within, I guess in Arizona's case, it's 72 hours, but you need to report it. Hypothetically, if you found an isolated bridge, I would argue that until you started sleeping under a different bridge, I wouldn't want you to have to report in weekly. If you're homeless and you have no money and no transportation, and you found a bridge where you can hide out and you can live out of a dumpster, why should you have to try to get to the sheriff's office every week? I mean, that's almost impossible. That begs a prosecution. But this is silly that even that this had to go to the Supreme Court. It would seem like to me that law enforcement could say, well, it does say that you have to provide an address. But since you don't have an address, just put down transient. Tell us as best you can where you're staying at night. And as you change your location, let us know. It seems like you wouldn't really need a court decision to get there.
The one part of that that seems even challenging from that respect is so you go park yourself under a bridge, which turns out to be like you think it's safe, but something happens that makes it not so safe. So you then move and it takes you possibly days to find the next place that might be safe. You can't, when you're supposed to like move, a mile up the road and to find the next bridge, which now you have 3 days to go find back to the popo office to register your address, which then you find out that that's not really the safest place, so you move a mile up the road again. How is that even supposed to work?
It's very difficult. But on the other hand, you have to be able to look at the other side. What if you could simply declare yourself transient,
yeah,
and actually not be transient, and you could keep your registry information from the public,
right?
If it said transient, that would kind of defeat the purpose of the registry. Of course, I don't believe the registry, so there's no need to send 1,000 emails saying that. But you need to be able to argue something from the other side. If you could simply say, I'm homeless, and you never had to disclose an address, and you never had to go back in again, wouldn't that be a great system?
It sounds to me like you're advocating for the registry, Larry.
Well, maybe it does, but I'm not.
I know you're not.
I'm saying when the person does change their location, that would be the time that they should be required to report something within a reasonable period of time. I don't believe in all this in-person reporting. I believe that people ought to be able to report basic information through electronic. I mean, we are in the 21st century, but a homeless person may not have access to those reporting.
Very true.
Through their telephone, they might be able to report this stuff, but I don't see any reason why you have to go in person.
Sure. Well, I mean, somebody I knew that was on parole here, and he would get phone calls at all hours of the day. And on some of those, if not all of them, he would have to take a picture, like a selfie picture, to prove it's him that's holding the phone and not his girlfriend or his mom, his cousin, whatever. And they're still in state, but he's off somewhere else. So he had some sort of, I don't want to call it facial recognition, but someone on the other end could just do a quick little comparison to make sure that it's really the guy on file. So I mean, if you can do it for parole supervision to make sure that you're you, why couldn't you do this for your annual or quarterly whatever registration stuff?
You could. It's not a question of whether you can. It's a question of us wanting to.
I mean, we could release an app in the Apple Store and on the Google Play Store. You could release an app. You take a picture. You update your stuff. Maybe they even have you required to where your address is registered to actually be there, and it sends off the GPS coordinates so that you've like verified that you're at that. I mean, it doesn't seem like it would be that hard to do.
It's not a question of not being hard. It's a question of wanting to do it. We've got a statute since 2013 that says that the state shall create an electronic, I forgot how it's worded, a portal where people can report changes of information. And here we are 5+ years later, they haven't created that because they don't want to.
Right. I mean, Facebook has 3 billion users and people are registering with that all the time. And you guys can't create it for what, 3,000 registrants, 4,000 registrants there?
And our Department of Public Safety under this conservative administration we have has fought tooth and nail, and they've just ignored the law. But that's hopefully will change. I mean, we're going to have a new administration in January. And hopefully, regardless of which party it is, that they'll actually choose to follow the law. I mean, that is what they put their hand on that Bible and swear to do.
I could knock out that app in a weekend, by the way. Just saying.
So the answer is it's not a question of that, why they can't do it. They don't want to do it.
Right, right. Cato is a, isn't Cato kind of a libertarian leaning joint, or are they left?
Yes.
Okay, I thought they were libertarian.
They're libertarian.
This article is Cato at Liberty. And it says states can't make up new laws just to punish old conduct just because they call them civil. A case from 06, person gets sentenced. I don't remember seeing where it happened, but he gets 48 months of imprisonment and then to register for 10 years. Like almost immediately. Oh, I guess this is in North Carolina. And then they drastically changed the provisions. And they make it so he has a 30-year registration scheme. And this means he can't go to the kids' school of functions. He can't go to PTA meetings, field trips, all that stuff. And this, I got to think, to me, this feels totally punitive, not just regulatory. I don't know of other regulatory schemes that put this many restrictions on what you can do. So this is being fought and, it's just ugly.
And it's on cert petition to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws has joined the petition support of, the court granting cert in this case. But the answer is you can do that until you're stopped. You can call anything regulatory until the courts agree that it's not. And this is going to put the Supreme Court in an interesting position, because the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in the Doe versus Snyder case said, well, the registration scheme was regulatory until you added the 2006 and 2011 amendments to it. It tipped the scale at that point, and it clearly is punitive now. Well, the Supreme Court declined to hear that case, basically affirming what the Sixth Circuit. So I would argue, if it were me writing the brief, and it isn't me, but if it were me writing the brief, I would argue that you have basically affirmed the Sixth and their reasoning. So therefore, this registration scheme in North Carolina has evolved with the enhancement that they've added, the many enhancements they added in 2006, including what Michigan did. They lengthened the term, and they put a lot of requirements. North Carolina's done the same thing. And I would argue that you've actually already made the decision on this case when you declined to grant cert to Doe versus Steyer.
Can you circle back and tell me what cert is and pronounce it very slowly so that I can hear it?
Cert is all you need to get familiar with it. It's a Latin term for the court.
Right, but there's like the full certiorari.
Well, there's two different
ways.
People pronounce it different ways, certiorari and certiorari and all these different ways. But it's the court granting. They don't have to hear a case at the Supreme Court. They get to pick and choose. There's only a few disputes that the Supreme Court must hear, and anything else is by choice. So when you want something to be heard by the Supreme Court, you file a cert petition and say, please look at this. And that's what's happening with Bethea. This case is on cert to the Supreme Court. They may choose to accept it, or they may choose to decline it.
So cert basically just means I am asking you to hear this. That's it?
That is correct.
I'm asking.
You spend a whole bunch of money filing your cert petition, and then if they grant cert, then you get to actually brief the case, and then you get to have oral arguments, because the Supreme Court almost always has oral arguments. So you get to brief the case, then you get to pay a whole bunch more money to print that brief, and you get to go to D.C. and hold. But once you get cert granted, everybody comes out of the woodwork. They're interested in the issue, kind of like with the Gundy case. So there's all these things because it has to deal with delegation. All these organizations are coming out saying that they should rule to limit the delegation of the Attorney General.
And you said Narsal is filing one on this case?
Narsal has filed.
Okay, they have. And so Cato has also filed an amicus brief supporting. And amicus brief is a friend of the court, is that correct?
Yes.
Or not a friend, or a friend of, in this case, it was a person petitioning. What is your thoughts on how this one's going to play out?
I think I wouldn't want to venture a prediction, but if they grant cert, this could go a long way towards doing what people had hoped in the Doe versus Snyder case, because everybody said they were just so confident the Supreme Court would affirm the Sixth if they actually take this case and they rule in favor of the offender, then we would essentially have some clear guidance from the Supreme Court that yes, you can tip a regulatory scheme to where it inflicts punishment, and that's what we've been hoping for. They will never say that you can't register people.
Sure. I get that, and ultimately that's not even a big deal.
A lot of people don't get that.
It's
going to end registration for all, and they're not.
Right, but like all this extra baggage that goes along with it. I mean, just like if we were just talking about, if you had to annually or something take a snapshot with your phone and put in your address and click submit, wow, that wasn't really that hard. It just doesn't feel like, you can do your driver's license that way. I don't see how this would be significantly different.
I'm trying to talk to the hundreds of people we have listening.
Believe
that the Supreme Court can somehow end registry schemes. They can't. They can limit how far they go.
And then in the case of North Carolina, they just decided to tack all the stuff on there, including the Packingham thing with you can't use social media forever.
And they got slapped out of that.
Right. So it almost feels like North Carolina feels like ground zero for all of these really good cases where they've overreached, but I don't know how that affects a state that may just do a teeny little bit of overreach where it would just be harder to prove anything. But if you have these guys that are just stepping so far out, it's really easy to see it and smack them down.
It will give us guidance if they take this case in terms of how far you can go before a regulatory scheme is no longer regulatory.
Is there a scenario in which somebody at this top level, I realize it wouldn't be SCOTUS, but is there a scenario where SCOTUS or somebody like that says, this is okay, this is not okay, this is okay, this is not okay? Does that exist where there's a definitive list of here are the 100 things you can and can't do?
Well, they won't be able to do that because they can only decide the challenges before them. So in the case of Michigan, they were able to tell them the things that they couldn't do. But Michigan is struggling to do as much as they can as they revamp their statutory scheme. And I do not believe that, regardless of what happens, that a state's going to say, well, we give up. We're just going to close down registration. If they get slapped down, they're going to go back and try to find out what they can do to have a registry scheme that doesn't go too far. And that's what we're hoping the Supreme Court will do, is say, this is how far you can go. You can't. I would love the day to come where they say you can't list people's home address on the internet.
Yeah.
I would love to see that. I would love to see the day when you can't limit where people live, that without some extremely strong due process procedural protections, without them proving that there is an imminent danger. I would like to see all occupational debarment end. I would like for people to be basically reintegrated into society after they pay their debt to society, and they can go about their life. And if they have to turn in a form once a year, I would not approve of it. But that would be constitutional.
Right.
When they start stacking things beyond turning in the form, it becomes more and more problematic.
Yeah. And I guess that's how you get there is, hey, you guys tried this. It got shut down. You build an exceptions list. You don't know what is accepted up front. But this was presented. It got shut down. Okay, well, they can't do that. This was brought up. This was shut down. They can't do that. They have to keep trying to run things at the flagpole. We have to keep them smacking them down.
Yes, and they will likely keep trying until public opinion goes against them. When the public starts calling their state senators or representatives and say, stop making laws that interfere with how people who have paid their debt to society live their lives, it'll stop. It's just right. That damn simple. It really is. But none of those calls were coming. The calls are coming just the opposite, saying, you keep me safe from these vile sex offenders. That's the calls they're getting.
Do they really sound like that?
Pretty much.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible. Well, and that ties directly into the next article that comes out of Providence, Rhode Island, the Providence Journal. Sex offenders' residences would further be restricted in Providence under ordinance amendment. And here is what this sounds like when you live in this particular community.
You gotta go! You gotta go! You gotta go! You gotta go! Stop it! You gotta go!
This is really crappy, Larry. This person, it doesn't matter what crime they committed. So now he's living in this town and you got people marching on your front doorstep with, I think it said 200 people had corralled around the guys on his front doorstep. Protesting, then they've got police officers there, like monitoring the situation, make sure that they don't cross the threshold up to his doorstep and stuff like that. Man, this is bad news.
It is really, really pathetic. And I guess this is from the city of Providence. And those that are listening may not know that the Rhode Island legislature expanded the buffer zone from 300 to 1,000 feet a few years back, and that case is in litigation, and there's a federal court has enjoined the state from enforcing that. They were going to retroactively have people vacate their homes, and amazingly, they can gear up to do these things really fast when it's going one way. It's always how slow they can, when something is going to help the offender, if there's a court victory, it's amazing how long it takes them to downsize and to reverse thrust. But in terms of they were ready to, they'd already served notices of eviction on people that were within the retroactively created 1,000 feet exclusion zone for level 3 offenders.
Mm-hmm.
And this is simply the city of Providence, as I understand it, trying to do what the state has already been blocked from doing. And it would be worth your while if you lived in Providence to kind of learned that you're going to end up losing this in court, just like the state's going to lose in court. If this is retroactive, if it has a retroactive component to it, which it sounds like that's what these people want, you've got to go. Would seem to me that they want this to be retroactive. Wouldn't you interpret it that way?
Yeah.
So if you don't mind paying taxes in Providence to pay for big attorneys, I think the legal fees in the Doe's versus Snyder, Michigan case, they finally settled on a figure of like $1.8 million for all the litigation it took to do the challenge.
Wow.
That the state ended up paying. If you guys don't mind paying your taxes, just keep doing stupid stuff like this. Because NARSL will contact the ACLU, and thanks for the person who sent the article, and we will find out. We've already raised money to the tune of about $15,000 to help fund the other lawsuit. We will help with this if needed. Because you're not going to retroactively remove people from their homes in the United States of America without any pushback. So get used to it. We're here and we're going to come for you again if you didn't learn anything the first time.
Hey, this might not be a bad time to throw in the disclaimer about the separation of the podcast and Narsal. Just to keep it clear.
Yes, well, I am a board member, and I generally coordinate the legal projects, and this is one the board has approved in terms of making a firm stand against retroactive. We don't support residence restrictions, period.
Right.
But it's bad enough that you have the exclusion zones. It's offensive in the United States of America that you're going to deprive someone and tell them, oh, well, we just changed the rules. You get to leave your home. And in some cases, those people have been in those homes for decades.
Right. They have owned them. And I remember this was when I first started getting involved with the Narsal, but there was, you had like a Narsal in action, advancing advocacy, whatever it was at the time. And there was like a whole lot of consternation about someone that has been renting a place for decades versus someone that owns it. Maybe the person has a domestic partnership, you know, like a common law marriage, but the title's in the spouse's name. Now you're going to kick that guy out versus the guy next door who's actually owning his home. He doesn't get kicked out. There was a whole lot of ambiguity there on which way that stuff would go too.
So yes, it did create challenges for those who didn't have ownership interest, and that a renter should have some interest if you've been renting a place for years or decades.
This is a mess also. I don't want to like bag on the Rhode Island people, but hey, your restriction went from 300 to 1,000 feet for tier 3 offenders. I don't think the 1 and 2s have any residency restrictions, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe they have the 300, but you know, other states, particularly, let's just call out Florida again for being Florida, and what is it, Miami-Dade has the 2,500 foot for everybody. It's just...
Well, this is Rhode Island, to their credit. They do have a risk-based system, and their argument will be if this case ever goes to trial, the state is stalling and running up the attorney bills on discovery, last report we had from the ACLU. But they at least have some rational argument. They're saying, well, we're not applying it to everybody. We're only applying it to the level threes. And they've been determined, not by offense, but by risk, to be level three. Therefore, they've had a due process determination. Okay, I'll accept that. But what you need to do is to grandfather them. And if you do that, you'll take the error out of the lawsuit. But they're not smart enough to do that, because that doesn't satisfy that crowd that you just heard yelling and chanting, you've got to go.
Yeah, right.
Nobody wants to go tell that angry crowd, I'm sorry, but in this country, we don't get to throw people out of their houses retroactively when we make a new law. You're going to have to get used to it. You can try to buy him out if you'd like. That's what I tell people. If you don't like what somebody's doing with their property, as long as it's not egregious safety violation, they may not keep their yard quite as neatly as yours. But if you don't like the way they keep their grass cut, buy the damn thing.
Right.
So
yeah. Okay. Wouldn't that support like the libertarian and the conservative's point? Hey, if you don't like the person living there, buy them out.
Well, that's my argument.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like it. I like it. I like it. And before the big conversation goes on, there's a lawsuit. I don't know where. I guess it's Bakersfield, California. I saw Janice Bellucci's name in there. But a sex offender sues county, saying 2008 housing restriction law violates civil rights. The plaintiff, who's listed as a John Doe, is saying that the 2,000 foot living restriction of a daycare is overly... it's punitive, that it violates the civil liberties, and he can't find affordable housing anywhere else that would fit within the guidelines. This is not terribly different than what anybody with residency restrictions would come up with, depending on how populated the area is. I mean, it effectively makes a banishment condition, which we've talked about from a constitutional standpoint, that you know we can split hairs over what the definition of banishment actually means.
Well, Janice, I always give her kudos for tackling this. She has a state Supreme Court ruling at her back. This ultimately will fall in Kern County, and I have no idea where Kern County is. California's too big. But whether or not she has the wind at her back, she has to be willing to step up. She has to be willing to file the lawsuit. She has to be willing to be ridiculed by people who do doxing, and she's recently been doxed. She has to be willing, and I give her kudos for filing the lawsuit. And where is Kern County anyway?
I mean, it keeps saying Bakersfield, like at the bottom of the article, it says there are 795 registered offenders living in Metro Bakersfield.
Well, then it must be the county of where Bakersfield's located.
Yeah.
Ultimately, this will cost the people of Kern County some money, and there'll be a settlement, and this will fall by the wayside, I do believe. And kudos to Janice for doing it.
It's a population of 840,000 people. It's on the, I shouldn't really say it's on the southwest side, because like the whole state's the southwest side. I can't really see where it is. I'm not that good at my geography. So we'll let that one go. But it's somewhere in California.
Well, Bakersfield. You know where Bakersfield is. It's over there.
It's over there. It's on the west coast. Yes. So there's that.
It's over there.
So do you think that this guy wins or loses?
I think he wins.
Cool. Gotta love victories. Well, then let's talk about, so we teased it last week, talking about the electronic internet kind of thing where we can't use the internet. And the Third Circuit says that it's unconstitutional to make an outright ban, even for someone that has done things like downloaded images and even solicitation kind of things. You could craft restrictions specifically around those things, but you can't say that the guy can't use Google Maps or he can't go try and find jobs. So you're driving this bus, man. Let me know what you think.
Well, I didn't have a chance to read it last week, but I have read it now. It's a 15-page opinion, and I think we should make it available to our listeners who would want to read it. We've
Absolutely.
Got a lot of legal beagles out there, and this is a very fine written opinion from the Third Circuit. This is a person who his name was Brandon Holina. Probably
yes.
not pronouncing it correctly.
Brandon Helena, yeah.
He solicited a minor, which he turned out, they never do turn out to be a minor, but he thought he was going to meet up with a 14-year-old, and the 14-year-old turned out to be the police, and he served his time, and then he came out with lifetime supervised release. This is a federal conviction, and he comes out with lifetime supervised release, and he's practically banned from using the internet, and he breaks those restrictions by violating and gets on Facebook, and so he has to serve more time in jail, and he ends up challenging the ban, and as I tell people routinely, a complete internet ban is probably unconstitutional. Can they do it? Yes, they can do it until they're stopped. And that's what they did to this guy, and he stopped them. He challenged the and took it up on appeal. The district judge didn't give him any satisfaction, and the Third Circuit reminded the district judge, and this case will be remanded for the district judge to narrowly tailor these restrictions. The court didn't say you can't restrict people; they said a total ban. But special conditions, as a general rule, I'm reading directly from the opinion on page 6, may not deprive the defendant of more liberty than reasonably necessary to deter crime, protect the public, and rehabilitate the defendant. And that references 18 United States Code, section 3583, subsection D2. And that is generally the decision, that's the guidelines which courts are looking at when a special condition is put on. That's the appellate review standard, is that special conditions have to be narrowly tailored, and there has to be a relationship to the crime. And this judge just made it where he couldn't use the internet. So the court found on page 7, the restriction's length, its coverage, and the defendant's underlying conduct. They considered those three factors, and it just didn't measure up. They say, we've never upheld a lifetime ban and a presidential opinion, and we have trouble imagining how a defendant can function in modern society given a lifetime ban on computer use. That's on page 8.
Right.
We have never upheld a lifetime ban. Now, never is a pretty long time.
It seems to be for all of time.
and they have trouble imagining how a defendant could function in modern society given a lifetime ban. This is not Larry saying this. This
right.
is me reading from the opinion. And when I tell people that, yes, your PO can hand you that paper. They can tell you to sign it. But just because they have you do it doesn't mean it would withstand a challenge. And then they go on page 10. On this record, we see no justification for stopping Helena from accessing websites where he will probably never encounter a child, like Google Maps, Amazon. The same is true for websites where he cannot interact with others and view explicit materials like dictionary.com or the court's website. The district court need not list all the websites that he may visit. It would be enough to give the probation officer some categories of websites as a guiding principle. So what the district court needs to do is to say, we want him to have limited access to minors through his internet communications. And then they can build a monitoring program of requirements to see to it that he doesn't go outside that scope, and that's permissible. And on page 12, they say that he needs the internet for shopping, searching for jobs and housing. The same is true for websites conveying essential information like news, maps, traffic, and weather. And the record does not justify banning benign use of computer without internet access. So this is a pretty broad opinion in terms of telling the district judges in the Third Circuit, if you're going to restrict someone from the internet, you better narrowly tailor it, and you better not get carried away. And this also can be argued with people, and they're not in the Third Circuit. This is a persuasive piece of authority. If you don't have the exact same opinion, similar opinion in your circuit, this is persuasive and can be cited in any circuit.
Now, do we all get big cojones and run right down to our handler's office and say, you can't restrict me from internet because the Third Circuit says so?
Well, if you lived in Pennsylvania, which is in the Third Circuit, you know, and I know people that would like to move there, this is what I would tell the people in Pennsylvania, that you need to read this opinion.
do you literally call the people in the receiving state and say, hey, you can't do that?
I wouldn't call the people. They would find another reason not to receive you. But once I got there, when they say sign this condition, I would hold this decision up and say, have you read this? Because you can't do that. And I would have to challenge it if you tried to impose that condition. No, I won't sign that.
Interesting. And if it's in that circuit, then this is the law.
This is binding. This is unless Pennsylvania straddles more than one circuit, and I don't know where the boundaries are. But if Pennsylvania is all within the Third Circuit, this is good law.
And further still, I mean, the way that that's reading is like, absent specific factual findings, we cannot say that forbidding Helena to write a novel or listen to music on his computer makes the public any safer. They're saying that, like, we can keep the guy from going to places where he might encounter kids or encounter porn, something of that nature. But otherwise, he's free to move about the internet. Is that the way I'm reading it?
That's the way I'm interpreting it. Now, we will know when the district court sets the conditions, because the district court is going to have to tailor some conditions for him. These are null and void according to the Third Circuit, which tells the district court what it can do. So they're going to have to set their new conditions, and then we'll find out if they go too far again, because he's already demonstrated he doesn't mind going to the Third Circuit, and he'll take it back again if they go too far.
And out of curiosity, from his point of view, to what degree of big cojones do you think he has for challenging these things?
Well, anytime you're going against the U.S. Probation Service, with the vast amount of resources they have, it takes a lot of courage, because they have resources to really make your life miserable. They have surveillance teams out the wazoo. They have investigative resources. I mean, think of the federal family of investigative, all the alphabet agencies started from the FBI, right, that they would have available to them. The feds are just, But I guess when you looked at having a lifetime of not being able to function in a modern society, he said, what do I have to lose?
There is that argument. I know that this was Third Circuit. Did this come from a state and make it up there?
No, this was a federal case to begin with.
It is a federal case. Does that hold any bearing for someone at a state level, that this is a federal oriented thing?
It's irrelevant of it, in my opinion. Okay. Because it's a dealing with First Amendment, and that's a constitutional U.S. constitutional protection. So a person in a state court could cite to this within the Third Circuit, and this is binding on them. They can, just like for example, the Von Behring decision in the Tenth Circuit in Colorado of dealing with the polygraphs. Anybody who's being forced to take a polygraph, they can assert a limited amount of Fifth Amendment self-incrimination right based on Von Behring if they own the Tenth Circuit, and they can cite to that. And in fact, the Utah Supreme Court issued its own decision citing Von Behring, saying that, that the person had the same rights under state law because of the Von Behring decision. So yes, this is good law. If you know anybody that would like to go to Pennsylvania, mention this to them.
Yeah, no doubt. Or anywhere else in the Third Circuit. There's something that just jumped out at me. It says the computer and internet bans both sweep too broadly. They are the antithesis of the narrowly tailored sanction we require. And the ban on using a computer or other electronic communication devices is particularly draconian.
Yes.
I love that word.
I highlighted that.
I love the word draconian.
Yes.
Which is what other countries say about our registry, but that's probably another conversation. Interesting.
That was it was one that I took with great interest once I read it. I said, we have to talk about this more.
Certainly, certainly.
I encourage people that are facing complete bans to consider your options. And of course, the big thing they're lacking is money. Even if you've got the stamina, right. these things generally cost money. This one had the public defender at his back.
Okay.
Because this was a criminal case, and the public defender gets to argue about conditions of supervised release that are excessive. But had he not had the public defender, would he have been able to afford this? Who knows?
Yeah, sure. Sure. Well, I'm going to leave it to you to read our outgoing quote, which I actually replaced because we brought up the principal person here to make this quote.
Is that right?
Yes.
It always,
I also think it's relevant. I think it's also relevant to our fight.
It always seems impossible until it's done.
Who said it?
Nelson Mandela.
I like it. I think that's a great quote. Because this is a tough fight, and it's going to seem impossible until we have success and until we win. So it's going to seem impossible.
So share the podcast with those you know, so that we can grow the audience.
Can we get more people to share it out? You know, I would really like. So here we are at our anniversary. Here, we have pretty strong numbers. I mean, you know, they're great. We would love that. Why can't we get 10 times as many people? Why can't we get? Do you want to try and come up with some arbitrary number to make for a goal?
Well, you need to get these conservatards off, and that would help control the numbers. I mean the libtards. Excuse me.
Libtards.
You get the libtards off.
We need to get the hosts off to get more conservatards on the pod.
You need to get more conservatives on and get the libtards off. And I totally misspoke there. That's an example of my dementia.
Right, that age thing does it to you. I was like, so we have 20 active patrons. So can we shoot for, 100 in the next year? Is that too much to stretch for?
I don't think so, because we tell everybody a buck. It doesn't seem like
too much to ask for a buck, right?
It's a numbers game. It's kind of like when we got our own channel, and I think it's 133 when I looked yesterday. We were trying to get that magic 100. We're trying to get a magic 100 patrons now.
Yep. So add a buck. That's all you got to do is a buck, and that would be awesome. And then as far as the number of downloads, we get something like 500 downloads a week. Why can't we get, 2,000 a week? Why can't we get 5,000 a week? So I think that we can reach these numbers. And what I'm then asking is for you people, our listeners, help share it. Find the people. You people in Florida, you have 30,000 people on the registry. Many of them are dead. They probably can't listen. You've got to know people. And if you need blue balls to help hand them out, I will send you blue balls. Everybody should share it with everybody, and we should be able to grow this to be a good chunk larger.
Well, what if they do come back and say, you need to get rid of the libtards? Then what do we do?
I maybe I masked your voice so you sound like Rush or Hannity.
So
where do people find us, Larry?
They find us very carefully at registrymatters.co.
What about a phone number for them to call in and leave some voicemail messages?
That's what I love the most is these voicemail messages. They can call 747-227-4477.
How about for an email address?
Send us an email to registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
And where can they go to support us, which is most appreciated? And as you said earlier, we are very humbled by the support. Where can they go?
That would be www.patreon.com/registrymatters.
Outstanding. And hey, if you want to get on the Discord server, if you want to hang out and chat, if you want to listen to us record the show, I really don't have a problem with that personally. You might hear some things that you really shouldn't ever repeat or share with anybody else, but I totally don't have a problem with it. But you know, we can build a community if you want to chat, if you want to ask questions. Maybe I can get Larry to come in here and we can type talk to people and ask some questions during the week or something like that. So let me know. Discord is a community chat. I mean, that's how we're recording the podcast now, is over Discord. So let me know if you want to get a link. I might put it up on the website. But if not, if you just ask me, I'll send it to you.
Sounds
good. Pretty much all I know, man. And Larry, thank you so very much. I appreciate the year you've given me. It's not always been easy, but I do very, very, very much appreciate you joining me.
Well, I've had a lot of fun.
I'm glad. And that's all I got. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night, Andy.
Bye.